and own a totally legit panda of your own.
Yeah. What was
like a Saint, looks like a Saint Bernard.
That's no lion.
You're listening to Reason Together, the podcast for Christians who think about stuff. I'm your host, Daniel Fox, here with my great friend, Thomas Balsamo. How are you, Tom?
I'm good.
Good. Best.
How are you?
I'm the same. Doing well, keeping busy. And I want to thank, as we begin our episode here, we want to thank our patrons over at patreon.com/reasontogether for all that you do to pay the bills and to keep things going here. And we can pay our editors. And I just appreciate your investment. The elite patrons, really the heavy hitters there. And we appreciate your investment. Thank you also for your feedback. And I'll just say at the outset here, whatever we're talking about, and even what we're not talking about, there's something on your radar that you want to put on ours. Send us some thoughts at reasontogetherpodcast@gmail.com. Some question maybe you've had, or just an angle on a thought that you'd like to share. We might like to bring that up in an episode and bat it around ourselves. And so just send it to reasontogetherpodcast@gmail.com, and we'd be glad to hear from you.
Yes. I'm grateful to our patrons, and yes. I have to reiterate that, because it really is a blessing to think that folks would actually give money to this. Just a couple of guys talking here on the internet, but thank you. why don't we jump right in? We've got several things on here, and some feedback, and then you've put a couple things on here, and I put a couple things on here.
Yeah, yeah, and we might get through most of this today.
Okay,
but I just have to start off with what I thought was a funny article that I read.
I saw this.
Yes, did you see the news article?
It did.
It was funny. When you realize the depths in a way that people go to try to cover for themselves, or they try to do something that, and they put quite a bit of work into it to produce this great con, and then they get caught on it. It's just amazing. So I read this article. It says zoo goers upset after discovering panda exhibit was painted dogs. And so I thought, that's got to be a chow dog. I remember these from when I was a kid. I just remember liking chow dogs, because they're so furry and big that way. And sure enough, I looked in there, and they had groomed and dyed the hair of these chow dogs in such a way that, I mean, they kind of did look like pandas in a way, though. It was funny. So you see him running around the cage and stuff. But the one thing that stuck out to me too was the one of them's got like this curly tail coming up the back, and I'm like, do pandas have a curly tail? I mean, I don't know. It looks kind of doggish, you know what I'm saying? But they really done the job of like dyeing them black and with a white this and all that, and like, oh my goodness, you're kidding me that a professional zoo made fake pandas. for their visitors. Oh my goodness.
At a certain point, it's just plain disrespectful. It's like, you know, they're going to get caught. They knew they were going to get caught. They had to have known at some point this ruse wouldn't last long, but they just didn't care. It's, I mean, you have to not care about the people that are coming to your zoo, I guess, to do this. It's like they just gave up trying.
it would be funnier. It would be better if they would just said, yeah, it was kind of a joke. Yeah, people caught on. Isn't that funny? But part of the article here says, when zoo officials were asked why they had tricked people into thinking the dogs were pandas, one zoo rep replied, quote, there are no panda bears at the zoo, and we wanted to do this as a result, end quote. Okay. Right. That was the obvious answer. Oh, we didn't have any, so we made some up. Well, I know, but like, what were you thinking?
It would have been better to just play it up as an intentional right. prank.
Exactly.
Like,
oh my goodness.
Like pandas, totally legit pandas here. You yeah. know, big arrow.
the on the sign, totally legit pandas.
Yeah, totally legit pandas here.
And he goes, wait, why are they calling them totally legit pandas?
Yeah. Anyway.
Oh, stars. So you might be able to skirt the exotic animal pet law by merely painting your dog to look like an exotic animal of sorts.
Yes.
And there you go. And own a totally legit panda of your own.
Yeah. Well, what's
like
interesting
Saint,
is
looks
of
like
course,
a Saint Bernard.
the That's Chihuahua. No lion. Well, that's like the that reminded me of that joke where, oh, how did it go now? There's a guy that gets hired by the zoo and he doesn't know what his job is yet. And he shows up on his first day. They give him like I think it was like a bear costume.
Yeah.
They say, put this costume on and go, you know, frolic around in the bear enclosure because we don't have any bears right now. Make it look good. And somehow, if I remember the joke right, he's frolicking around there and, you know, trying to look like a bear, and he slips and falls over the wall into the lion enclosure next to him. And he comes face to face with this lion, and all of a sudden he starts freaking out. And you can totally tell this is not a bear now, because he's standing up, he's panicking, he's talking out loud, screaming like a human. And because he thinks he's about to get eaten by the lion. And all of a sudden the lion looks up at him and goes, hey, buddy, be quiet. You're going to get us both fired.
Yes. Yes. Oh, my goodness.
Oh.
Okay.
What are we doing here?
Yeah. Yeah. So I thought that was funny. I got to start the episode with that.
Yeah.
But we had some patron feedback. Do you mind if I jump into that one?
We could, unless you think it'd be quicker to jump to your book recommendation, because I have one too.
Sure. Yeah. A book I've been listening to recently and nearing the end of it, I've really appreciated some thoughts that it has provided on the issue of parenting. And that is the title of the book itself. It is Parenting by Paul David Tripp. And what I appreciate is that he doesn't discount the need for rules and consequences and accountability mm-hmm. and things like that in the home. But at least the way I interpret it, I thought a couple really good points that he draws out, or at least that came to my mind as I was reading as a result of what he was saying. Number one, kind of what we talked about in our last episode with grace and law, that the rules in the home are good and they're necessary, but the answer to a broken rule isn't more rules, or just the conformity to the rules isn't the end in itself.
Right.
It's to use the broken rules, which show structure and which are for safety and have benefit, but to show at every juncture of breaking the rules is an opportunity to point to grace, to say mm-hmm. we all need to be transformed and we cannot be transformed by the law. The law simply exposes who we are so that we look to the grace that can transform us. Of course, that grace is from God. And so I thought that was a really good point. And then highlighting that, you know, reminding you as a parent that that this is good, that this don't see discipline as a frustration, like, oh, great, I've got to deal with them again, because you have little sinners and you are God's provision to them for, you know, again, pointing them in the right direction and teaching them and discipling them. And so part of that is revealing at those moments the heart issue that's being exposed by the sin. And he talks about how a good thing can become a bad thing when it becomes a ruling thing, that there's certain desires and innate issues that we have. We want to be accepted. We're made to be accepted. We're social creatures. But when that acceptance becomes, you know, a God to us, and so we do things to gain people's acceptance, you know, whatever, yeah, then it becomes a ruling thing, and that it's exposed, wow, in our actions. Yeah. And so when you can bring your child to see the heart that's being manifested in here and how it's not directed in the right direction. Anyway, I just thought, and again, it's not to say that there are no consequences anymore because we're talking about grace. No, it's saying every moment as a parent that you have to see the weaknesses and the frailties of your children, number one, you're reminded that you need that same grace, but mm-hmm, two, you're pointing them to the grace. Not that there's no consequences, but you're pointing them to grace that truly transforms in dealing with the heart of your child. I thought that was very good.
Yeah, I was sitting there listening, thinking, wow, we hadn't really talked beforehand about what our book recommendations were going to be.
Yes.
But they mesh very well together, especially what you talked about as far as using rules to gain acceptance. Mm. The book, and I might have recommended this a few months ago back when I read it, but if I can't remember if I did or not, so I'm going to recommend it again just in case. But it was written by Ginger, formerly Duggar. Mm-hmm, her married name is Vuolo. I think that's how you say it. But her book is called Becoming Free Indeed. Mm-hmm. Fantastic book. And it kind of deals with what you're talking about the proper place of rules and talks at length about the misuse of rules like that. And I guess what made me think of it was the other day, she was on the Grace and Truth podcast, Owen Strahan, I think is how you say his name. Hmm. And fantastic interview. And then her husband was on as well, talking about the gospel. Mm-hmm. Again, along the same lines of what we're talking about. So like when raising kids, you know, you have an important rule like, hey, don't play around or hang around in front of the stove when your mother's cooking or when daddy's cooking something, frying up something. I mean, don't be hanging around there. Don't be grabbing up at things there. You're going to pull something down on yourself and you're going to get burned. So the rule becomes very serious, right? Because it's there for their protection. And that's a good and valid purpose of the rule.
Sure.
But as they get older, it might come time where you say, okay, come on over here. I want you to hang out in front of this stove with me. You're going to learn to cook something. Right now, all of a sudden, yeah, the rule is different. In you might say it's more lax. It has changed. It has, in a sense, disintegrated because they're more mature and they have to learn to do something with this tool now. And it plays very well into the good and proper place of rules for protection purposes. But not every rule is an absolute or permanent rule. Sometimes they change with maturity. Mm-hmm. On the podcast that, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes, they were talking about, as far as in the place of churches, about unwritten and unspoken rules. And anyway, I digress. I'll let you just go ahead and listen to it. I'll put it in the show notes, but it's a fantastic thing. And I recommend folks listen to it.
Yeah. You talking about the Grace and Truth podcast or the mm-hmm. book?
The podcast and the book.
The interviews because there.
The podcast reminded me of the book that I had read or listened to a few months back.
What's the name of that again? Because is it Grace in Truth or Grace and Truth?
Grace and Truth with Owen Strahan or Strahan, Strahan. I don't know how you say his name.
Okay.
But I've only listened to a few episodes of it so far, and it's really, really good podcast so far.
Not exactly finding it, so I'll have to follow the link there when you post it. All right. Let's see here.
We had some feedback real quick on that last conversation, kind of in the same vein. From some listeners about the opposite of grace.
Oh, yes, right.
And we had talked about
good thoughts.
So like two aspects of it, just to recap. Mm-hmm. Soteriologically speaking, and that's a million-dollar word meaning the doctrine of salvation or relating to the doctrine of salvation, grace and law are kind of opposites. That's at least how they're presented in scripture, in books like Galatians and in passages in Romans, that these are opposed to each other, soteriologically speaking. But as far as the virtue of grace, and I think that's more where we were talking about last time, was sort of the virtue of grace. The opposite of it one of the things we came up with was selfishness. If grace means to give freely, whether it be a material thing or a spiritual thing, or even in this, in the case of salvation and sanctification, an ability we don't have in ourselves, God gives it. that is grace. So the opposite of that would be to withhold that, right? Selfishness would maybe be a good word to use in there. And we asked our listeners, what other word could we use to describe the opposite of grace? And we had a couple of submissions on that. And Sydney was the first one that replied. This is in the patron message board. If you're wondering how you get on there, you got to be a patron, unfortunately. But Sydney says,
start like down about where the word either ungrace. Yeah. I like that. I like the way he sets that up to say if grace is this, recognize if grace is God recognizing our state and providing gifts for us that we do not deserve, then the opposite could be two things. You want to go on with that?
Yes. Would be either ungrace would be God ignoring our state. Ignoring would maybe be the emphasis there.
Right.
Yeah. Or it would be the utter non-existence of his provision. Mm-hmm. Interesting. He says, I believe you could use uninvolvement or indifference as possible one word answers to what is the opposite of grace. Indifference, I thought, was a good one there, especially. And he said, this discussion reminded me of Luke 11:5-13. Are you looking that up?
Sure. I wasn't, but I will.
Oh, okay. I thought that's what you're doing.
No, Luke 11:5. And he said unto them, which of you shall have a friend and shall go unto him at midnight and say unto him, friend, lend me three loaves. Then for a friend of mine in his journey has come to me and I have nothing to set before him. And he from within shall answer and say, trouble me not. The door is now shut and my children are with me in bed. I cannot rise and give thee. I say unto you, though he will not rise and give him because he is his friend, yet because of his importunity, he will rise and give him as many as he needeth. And I say unto you, ask and it shall be given you. Seek and ye shall find. Knock and it shall be opened unto you. For everyone that asketh receiveth, and he that seeketh findeth, and to him that knocketh it shall be opened. If a son shall ask bread of any of you that is a father, will he give him a stone? Or if he ask a fish, will he for a fish give him a serpent? And on he goes there. I guess he's going, maybe going through 13. If ye then being evil know how to give good gifts unto your children, how much more shall your heavenly Father give the Holy Spirit to them that ask him?
Yeah, good connection there, Sydney. I like the word indifference there.
And I...
Maybe even better than selfishness.
I like the other one too, because when he mentions uninvolvement, it makes me think about the revelation of God, that God by nature is light. He is one who reveals himself. And you have to, in some ways, recognize that every revelation of himself is a good. It's a good thing for us to see and to know him. So, so the opposite of grace would be uninvolvement, like not revealing himself, which is contrary to his nature. But
the other one we got was from James, and he suggested the word negligence as a possible word for the opposite of grace. And now he didn't explain this particular part in his answer, but I'm going to go ahead and add to what he said here. So I don't think what James is talking about, and I'm assuming here, he's not talking about negligence in the legal terminology. Because like if you ask what folks mean by negligence today, sometimes what they are implying by that is that someone didn't really know what they were doing. They were incompetent. And thus an error was caused by their incompetence. In the legal terminology, they would, if I'm not mistaken, they would call that negligence, right?
Okay.
But I think what the actual usage of the word was before, I guess the legal commandeering of it, would have been marked by neglect. Like the characteristic of neglecting something, failing in some way to pay attention to a particular need.
Which goes right hand in hand with what Sydney was saying, uninvolvement, indifference.
Indifference
to something. Yep. Hey, I think you guys hit really close there. I mean, that was good. Mm-hmm. Good thoughts. I appreciate that. Because, boy, as we brought up that question, it was kind of like, whoa, what? I hadn't thought to think of what the opposite of grace was, but you have provided some helpful insight there. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And I guess that's why we call it Reason Together around here. It's not just you and me sometimes. It's our patrons and listeners as well.
Reason by myself, which is kind of impossible. So you've got one down here. Was this a suggestion of somebody else or yours?
Which one?
A Christian.
Oh, yeah, that one. This is more just an interesting thing I came across. I'm not really sure what to think about it yet. So, like, I didn't spend a whole lot of time thinking about this because I figured we'd maybe bat it around some. Mm-hmm, but you're familiar with Todd Friel of Wretched Radio. Doing that a long, long time.
Yeah.
I remember even when I was a kid hearing him on the radio.
Wow.
Yeah. And he has an organization known as the Gospel Partners Media.
Okay.
And they have a number of contributors that have over the years given articles and videos and different resources involved in Gospel Partners. People like Ken Ham, which we're familiar with, Answers in Genesis, and Jason Lyle, who I really like, who's also affiliated with Answers in Genesis. He's the astronomer, physicist, whatever he is, he's really smart. And he's written some pretty significant works on logic and how it is evidence of God's existence. Logic itself is evidence of God's existence. And then there's a couple others. Tim Challies as well is a contributor there who has a great blog, lots of helpful articles. And I forget the last guy's name, but he works alongside John MacArthur. I think his last name is Johnson.
There's a few here. John Kratz, Andrew Walker, Tyson Bigney.
Yep. But anyway, I've noticed over the last several years, Todd Friel seemingly quotes the Daily Wire often. And you and I follow the news on the Daily Wire and listen to some of their podcasts. And I've seen some sort of crossing on the Venn diagram there in some of Todd Friel's work. And then he comes out with this thing that got the Gospel Partners, essentially with all of their contributors, is looking to – did you click on the video link there?
I did.
Yeah, you did. There's a video I put a link to as well as an article on their site. And they actually call it this, not me. So this is their words, not mine. The idea of starting a Christian Daily Wire.
Huh.
Again, the video is a little lengthy. I kind of scrubbed through some of it. But that's an ambitious endeavor. And I guess his goal is to kind of tighten up the Christian perspective around the news. That's my guess. And I mean, the Daily Wire gives a good conservative perspective of the news often, but not all of the contributors are coming from the same worldview. I think what they're looking to do is essentially start something similar to the Daily Wire, but with all of them being on board with the Christian worldview. Ambitious project. I thought I would just put it out there and just because I thought it was interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those, I got a couple of thoughts that come to mind, I guess, is that you question, number one, it seems like maybe there's been people who tried this in the past, basically giving the news from a Christian point of view. And I don't know how much traction that's gonna, gain because, a lot of people like the news, but they don't care about the Christian part. To say you've got your intellectuals that maybe go after Jordan Peterson and will be somewhat, misguided there. Not that they're saying they won't engage with him on a philosophical level, or, you have a thinker like, the Jewish fella,
with Daily Wire.
The white-haired guy. They sort of partner with him.
Dennis Prager.
Yeah, Dennis Prager. You know, a guy who's been prolific in media and a thinker. And And, you know, so anyway, yeah, you got some good thought base there. I mean, some intellect going into that. But then when you try to tweak that by saying, but a proper theology would have us see how many people that say, listen to the Daily Wire that are conservative like that really want a Christian spin on it.
Yeah.
You have to question, you know, whether or do you just applaud conservative news and then keep being a Christian and
it's sharing. Almost like I've been a Swiss Army knife guy for most of my life. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Swiss Army knives are great. They have a bunch of little tools in them that can do this or that, but there's no single tool in it that does its job perfectly. Right.
Right. Right.
They're all a pocket sized microcosm, you know, attempt of a tool. And it's the same could go for Leatherman and all those multi-tools. They don't do everything perfectly. And that's not what they're intended to do, right?
Right.
If you want a real good set of pliers, don't use a Leatherman. Buy a real good set of pliers, right?
Yeah, that's a good thought.
And I think like in the case of the news, you know, the Daily Wire does a pretty good job. And there's others out there, not just the Daily Wire. There's other conservative sources as well. Mm-hmm. And they do good at the news, right? Their goal isn't to bring in theology and the Christian perspective, unless it's a supporting article or a random submission from a contributor. And the Gospel Partners, and I guess it's kind of in the name, their goal is to be a theological organization. And by saying they want to start a Christian Wire, a Christian Daily Wire, it makes me think they're trying to be sort of a multi-tool.
Hmm.
And I feel like, and I hope it's not true. You know, I wish them well on it, but I hope that it doesn't
distract
come across
them.
As sort of a multi-tool where they don't do either of the things well.
Yeah. You know? Or that it, yeah, it, that it becomes, you take people who are good in their own tool, if you will.
Yeah.
And you bring them into a combination that, I guess you have to see what they can
but
do.
I can understand the frustration though and why they would want to do this, because for example, the Daily Wire does try to bring in the Christian perspective, or let me just say they try to bring in a biblical perspective with Jordan Peterson. Of all the people you can choose to bring in topics and content about the Bible, they pick Jordan Peterson, who in my personal view is a very confused man when it comes to biblical things. I suspect that Jordan Peterson, while he is favorable to the Bible, I don't know that he's genuinely born again or understands the gospel. There was a clip of him that I listened to, an audio clip from the Sean Ryan podcast. Occasionally I will hear clips from his podcast. And he asked Jordan Peterson directly something like, do you believe in God? Do you believe the Bible? Like you talk about a lot. Do you believe it? And the answer he gave was probably 10 minutes long. And I don't think he ever came around to saying anything of real substance about the Bible. I mean, a couple of places he got close as far as what he thought applications of the Bible stories mean. But for the most part, he allegorizes everything that he takes from Scripture and just philosophizes endlessly about it and how it connects to natural law in some sense. But I just don't think he's really hitting the mark of what the intent of the Bible is.
And the other contributors there certainly bring in a religious perspective, and at times they make statements that are so bold that you say, "Boy, maybe we are maybe they're pretty close here." Some maybe not so much as others. Whether you have obviously from one side you have a Jewish rabbinic perspective, another one you have a very Catholic traditional perspective, and then you have one that's just interesting. So anyway, it just. They bring a religion into it. Maybe some of these conservative theologians, or I'm saying more evangelical theologians, are saying, but they need to hear the truth with the news. You know, they need to be people need to be confronted with the truth of scripture and not tradition or this or that. But I don't know. I haven't really followed it. I don't know what he's doing.
And for all I know, they're not really looking to tackle the news as much as mm-hmm. they are just looking to create a conglomerate of contributors for biblical topics.
A conglomerate of religious, assumedly evangelical thought.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, perhaps that's what they're trying to do.
And yet they're still going to, whenever you typically or oftentimes when you create a conglomerate, you have to have to some degree a least common denominator. So, you know, I'm questioning what is the theological spectrum which these men fall in? Are they typically Calvinistic or Reformed, or is there more of a spectrum on various issues? And if so, what's the consensus? You know what I mean? What can't they talk about? Or, you know, what's going to be their approach to, yeah, what are they trying to teach? What's the core issue? I don't know. Anyway, interesting.
Yeah, all that to say, I'm interested to see where it goes. I'll provide a link in the show notes to it so listeners can check it out for themselves. But
okay,
curious to see where it goes.
Let's see here. I'm going to jump into this one here that was contributed by a patron, Nathan. And he said, I have the privilege of preaching and teaching on a regular basis at a small church plant in a village not far from where I live in West Africa. While French is the main language we use here, it is most people's second or third language. The church is made up of people from several different tribal groups, each with their own language, and most people are naturally more comfortable speaking their native language. One individual in particular, whenever praying out loud at church, always chooses to pray in her native language rather than in French. Since most people don't understand what's being said, is this the kind of thing Paul was talking about in 1 Corinthians 14 concerning unintelligible tongues that aren't edifying to the church? If so, should this lady be told she needs to learn to pray in French, or does it matter since God is the main audience and he can understand her just fine? I'll reserve my thoughts and let you answer first.
I'm just kind of scanning over Romans 14 for a second here, just refreshing on it, because I'm wondering, so like she's praying in church and I'm wondering if 1 Corinthians 14 is dealing with the topic of public prayer, or is it dealing specifically with the idea of preaching? So it mentions in verse 3 the idea of prophesying, right? Mm-hmm, which, in my mind, I would equate that more with preaching, right?
And, right.
Uh-huh. The term that he's using there is more akin to preaching. So I don't know that public prayer is necessarily in view here, though I think there's some crosstalk between the two concepts. Because when you're talking about prayer, I mean, yes, God is the primary audience who is being spoken to there. So does it matter if anyone else in the room understands? That's a tough question. I think 1 Corinthians 14 deals more with the idea of preaching. And if that's what he was dealing with solely, then yes, I do think 1 Corinthians 14 applies, particularly because of what is said in verse 11, where Paul says, therefore, if I know not the meaning of the voice, I shall be unto him that speaketh a barbarian, and he that speaketh shall be a barbarian unto me. Even so ye, for as much as ye are zealous of spiritual gifts, seek that ye may excel to the edifying of the church. In other words, edification was the goal here. And essentially, it doesn't matter. I mean, if he's saying if this guy is up there preaching and he's saying things that can't be understood by anyone listening, this is pointless. There's no edifying happening. In order for edification to happen, what you're hearing has to be intelligible. And Paul seems to place an emphasis on that. But again, it seems to revolve more around preaching here, unless I'm missing. Oh, wait, no.
Yeah, in verse 13, he brings it in.
I just saw it. I just kept reading here. He brings prayer in there as well. See, that's why it helps to keep reading. So, yeah, I would say if Nathan's question is this what Paul was talking about in Romans 14? It kind of seems like it is at first blush.
I mean, I think your point is well made that that largely he may be talking about the edification of the church through preaching, though he mentions in there, pray, if I, you know, if I pray, let's see, where is it here? For if I pray in an if I pray in a tongue, my spirit prayeth, but my understanding is unfruitful. What is it then? I will pray with the spirit, and I will pray with the understanding also. I will sing with the spirit. I will sing with the understanding also. So there's other aspects of worship kind of brought into the context too.
Yeah.
Though I would say, you know, one thought that struck me is that when he's talking to the Corinthian people, I question whether he's really talking to people that are of multiple tribal dialects here. What he was dealing with was the gift of tongues and the misuse, if you will, or the indiscretion of the use of tongues in mm-hmm. this corporate environment in that time. That it really wasn't edifying to the church. Is he dealing with somebody who's not praying in a second or third language because it's difficult for them to even speak in it? You know what I mean? Or
well, I think the principle is the same, whether someone is speaking in some alleged angelic tongue, right, and making gibberish, or speaking in French when the audience there speaks a different language than French. The result is the same. Nobody understands.
Well, true, true. But I mean, the Corinthian believers, instead of just speaking their native tongue, they were somehow using the gift to speak in a foreign tongue.
Yeah.
Well,
and
in
that's
this
fair.
Case,
I'm not disagreeing with you on that.
Yeah.
I'm just saying the result would be the same whether you're dealing with this gift that's being spoken of in chapter 14 or in Nathan's circumstance.
But to address the person and say, you need to learn to speak in French, I think you'd have to be careful how you say it because you're asking a it's a slightly different circumstance. You're asking them to become comfortable in a secondary language. However, I think the point could be made at some point, even as a point of discipleship, to say, you know, I appreciate your heart, but when you pray in your tribal tongue, there are people here that don't hear your prayer, and so they can't unify in heart in the same way that they could if you tried. And if you tried in French and you were uncomfortable with it, they're not going to mock you. They're not going to laugh at you for stammering before the Lord in an attempt to edify the church. And so I can see cause for caution in the approach. I don't think it's unwarranted to talk, though it's a slightly different situation than maybe what we're dealing with 1 Corinthians 14.
Yeah, slightly different, but very related, I think. There was a time years ago I got to preach in a Russian-speaking church in Brooklyn, New York.
Oh, wow.
And there was an interpreter there, not only for my preaching, but when I opened and closed in prayer, the interpreter interpreted my prayer as well.
Yeah.
So
that's an excellent point.
I feel like you could solve the problem if indeed it is a problem. You could at least alleviate it or help in some way by having an interpreter.
Absolutely. I mean, because just same thing like you're saying, you go on a missions trip and we don't know the language at all. And in order to communicate at all and be a blessing to the people, you're constantly running through an interpreter. So in this case, where maybe a few of them can understand, but the rest can't. Well, then have somebody interpret for her.
That's really the same solution that,
right.
that chapter 14 gives in verses 27 and 28.
One of the solutions, yes.
One of the solutions, yes. If one of them is to keep silence. one is to have one interpret, right? But he says, if there be no interpreter, let him keep silence in the church and let him speak to himself and to God. So I think there's definitely a relationship between what Nathan's situation is and this chapter.
Yeah, neat question, you know, and you know, something we don't stop to think about. But in countries where, you know, here we are in this vast country where there is a national language. Of course, I know we have a lot of immigrants now that, you know, whether it's Spanish primarily, but Spanish speaking. So then you kind of have a, two languages there, but you know, in a country where you have a trade language and a national language and a tribal language or whatever, you deal with stuff that we don't even think about here in the United States. And so that's a good question, Nathan. I appreciate it. What's this yard sale deal? I'll bring up this last question in the after show about authority and submission, but
Yeah, this one is, I guess it could be a serious question. So let's say you're at a yard sale, right? And you are a connoisseur, an aficionado of, I don't know, sunglasses. Let's go with that. I'm just picking something random.
Yeah, let's go with that.
And you know your sunglasses, right? And you're at this yard sale and you see this amazing pair of sunglasses there that's worth like $350, $400. Mm-hmm. Let's say it's worth $1,000. Okay. They're in good condition, right? And all they need is just a little bit of cleaning, you know, but they're in great condition. You know, you could sell those things for hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And you're talking with the person running the yard sale and you're like, how much for these? And they're like, I don't know, $5. Now there's this maybe somewhat moral dilemma in your mind.
Because you're like, 250? Would you take 250? No, just kidding. I'm kidding.
Right? That's exactly what I'd be thinking. No. No, part of me would be like, $5? Fine, here you go.
Yeah.
But there's another part of me that goes, am I exploiting this person's ignorance of sunglasses? And I kind of suspect, my personal opinion is, and I'm willing to listen. If I'm wrong about this, I'm willing to listen. But I kind of suspect that if they didn't take the time to actually look into the value of what they have, part of me thinks, you know, they sort of have it coming that you get a really good deal out of that.
Yeah.
If they're going to sell it, they probably ought to know something about it. And if they lose $1,000 pair of sunglasses and get only $5 out of it, I kind of feel like, well, fair's fair. Yeah. But am I wrong?
No. Well, I personally don't think so. I think the difference would be if you conned them out of the glasses and said, oh, this is a cheap pair. Man, I mean, I'd maybe give you a five for it, but you know, if you deceived them about the glasses to get it for a cheaper price. But if they simply said,
sure,
look, I'm going to sell my whole bedroom suite for $50. You're like, oh, okay, sure, fine, I'll take it. You know, I mean, if that's your choice. Now, if it's a friend of yours and you have a desire to try to help them out, hey, buddy, you could make more money on this. Ask $200 for these. It's still a good deal. You'll make a lot of money. But it's not our job necessarily either to run around worrying about whether everybody's getting the best deal on everything and trying to. It's almost like the opposite of the warning ministry, you know, that points out the bad of everybody is like trying to point out the good of everything, like running around the grocery store saying the grapes are really good price right now. Make sure you pick up the grapes, you know, look, if they see it and they want it, you know, they saw the end cap that stuff was marked down 90%. Great. If they don't, okay. Maybe they weren't looking for it. Maybe they don't care. And so, yeah, I don't think the issue is whether there's deceit, but if there's not a deceit and they simply are giving a good deal, you don't know why, you don't ask, you just pay the money, you walk away and it's great. I think of the verse Proverbs 20:14, and that's the picture that I kind of get in that when it says, it is not, saith the buyer, but when he's gone his way, then he boasteth. I think it's the idea. They go, oh, it's nothing. And he walks away. He's like, man, did I get a good deal there? That can happen. And I don't think that's necessarily a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe our listeners would have some feedback on that. Do you think that if I did that, and by the way, just to be clear, I didn't, this is just an example. I heard someone had a really great yard sale find because of this exact situation. The person didn't know that they were selling something valuable. And I'm like, well, great, good for them. They got a great deal.
Yeah,
and then part of me is like, you know, I think there's probably some Christians out there that think you would be morally obligated to tell them and then pay them what it's worth. But what do you think, listeners? Send us some feedback. Let us know. Are we being horribly immoral people by taking a good deal like that or not?
It's if you haven't unfriended us already and shut off the podcast and deleted us from your feed already, we ask you to respond to Reason Together Podcast at gmail.com. Hey, thanks for listening.
Both of you.
Yeah.
If you've made it this far.
Yeah. Thank you, listeners, for joining us today. Again, send your thoughts our way, reasontogetherpodcast@gmail.com. We appreciate you listening. We appreciate the opportunity. We're encouraging balance, developing perspective, and connecting faith to practice. This is Reason Together.